The following is brought to you by Will Harris, Dustin Campbell, Daily Tech News Show, Andy Beach, Nick Wood, and Craig.
Politics, 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 politics.
Hello and welcome everybody to the Politics, Politics, Politics program for June 3rd, 2022. Your old pal Justin Robert Young joining you in Austin, Texas. And baby, we are all about Biden on this Friday edition of the program. We are going to talk about Biden's pivot toward the economy. He doesn't want to seem absent on inflation. And I gotta say, with a few little caveats, I don't think that this is as baffling of a strategy as some of his others have been. We will also be joined by Bill Scheer. He has a new column out for Washington Monthly in which he says Biden learned the wrong lessons from Obama. And more specifically, from the legislative trials and tribulations of Obama. Even more specifically, that while Obama got things done, he didn't get enough, and he wasted time on the way to do it. So what is the accumulation and application of those lessons? A largely wasted first 2 years in office, at least according to Bill Scheer, whom I happen to agree with. We get into all that. And by the way, if you want a deep dive, and I mean put on one of those old-fashioned dive suits that has the bubble head and then the little window that you open and close, if you want that level deep dive into the Obamacare passage and the trials and tribulations of the public option, oh, baby. Are you going to get that and more? But first, Joe Biden has a new editorial in the Wall Street Journal, wherein, in my opinion, he has fired the starter's pistol on his midterm strategy. While it will no doubt be built out from here, what I suspect he is hoping to do is take his administration from a wartime catch-as-catch-can strategy, which he's kind of been in from the border crisis to Afghanistan, then to Ukraine. He has not dictated. He has been dictated to. And so this week, here it is, no more playing catch-up. We are going to play the music and everyone else is going to dance. And to start the concert, he's talking about inflation. Now, I know you guys love when I talk about journalism, so let's talk about journalism. There is no ambiguity as to why this editorial runs where it runs. He is not talking to the faithful. He is trying to talk to persuadable conservatives who are probably going to vote in the states of Georgia, Nevada, Arizona, and Vermont. That is New Hampshire. That is who he is trying to speak to here. It's not in the New York Times. It's not in the Atlantic. It's not in Teen Vogue. It's not in the Washington Post. It is in the Wall Street Journal. Historically the domain of establishment Republicans, and an institution that has not been shy about flashing never Trump credentials. And so we have the editorial itself, for which now I'm going to say some positive things about Biden and his strategy so far, because I do think that it is fundamentally sound, or at the very least competent. But I do just need to read this lead because I think it says so much about this Biden administration. Here we go. The global economy faces serious challenges. Inflation is elevated, exacerbated by Vladimir Putin's war in Ukraine. Energy markets are in turmoil. Supply chains that haven't fully healed are causing shortages and price hikes. There is a strategy often employed in business. In fact, many of you are probably used to it. You also see this with creative endeavors. It's called the complement sandwich, wherein if I want to tell you that your podcast is too long, I would say, I loved the opening theme. I think you have real pacing issues in the middle, but your overall message is fantastic and you need to get it out into the world. See what I did there? Compliment, criticism, compliment. The compliment sandwich. The criticism is the meat. What Joe Biden has here is an excuse sandwich. An excuse sandwich. I'm going to break it down here for you. Because in my mind, if I am writing this, there is no doubt that the first paragraph, the first sentence, I also like one sentence leads, if not one word leads. I don't know. It brings you in. The first sentence has to be inflation is out of control or inflation is elevated. In fact, let's just take what he writes. Inflation is elevated. Boom. Three words. One, two, three. Everybody understands the problem at the very least. Even if you disagree with what Joe Biden says past that, at the very least, we can all agree on one thing right now. Inflation is elevated. Let's start there. We move on. So he has the truth there, but he puts it in this excuse. It's not even a sandwich because no sandwich has three buns at the bottom of it. First, the global economy faces serious challenges. Translation. This isn't just us / this isn't my fault. Inflation is elevated. Good. Perfect. Start there. But that's not even its own sentence. Inflation is elevated, exacerbated by Vladimir Putin's war on Ukraine. Energy markets are in turmoil. Supply chains haven't fully healed, are causing shortages in price hikes. So we have Vladimir Putin's war in Ukraine. The energy markets are in turmoil and supply chains. So it's like inflation is elevated. Not my fault, not my fault, not my fault. First, this is happening to everybody. Second, it's also not my fault. The other thing that I found very interesting about this is that Joe Biden is now a deficit hawk. Let's go ahead and read directly from the editorial. Quote, we need to keep reducing the federal deficit, which will help ease price pressures. Last week, the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office projected that the deficit will fall by $1.7 trillion this year, the largest reduction in history. Oh, wither the days that Joe Biden allowed Bernie Sanders to shepherd his signature social safety net legislation. It appears that Biden now sides with Joe Manchin in believing that Americans view an increase in the federal deficit as being tied to inflation, for which I think is a wise decision. By the way, there was a moment in Iowa in 2020. And I was at a Mayor Pete event, and Pete trotted out being a deficit hawk Democrat, or at least a deficit conscious Democrat, as a way to differentiate himself from Bernie Sanders. And I wondered then, I was like, wow, you know, that's interesting. Interesting for Pete. It appears that that is now the opinion of Joe Biden, which is odd because I don't know. He's been in the Senate forever, so like he's had every opinion at some point, but that always felt like it fit more with his character. Biden also takes a shot at Rick Scott of Florida, who released a plan against the wishes of Mitch McConnell that indeed would increase taxes in some cases. That's easy win for Biden. so smart for him to go after it. Now, Biden followed this up, and he mentions the Federal Reserve in this editorial, but he followed it up with a visit to the Fed, where he effectively said, hey, please continue doing things. Don't mind me. Now, this is interesting for two reasons. That A, he wants to acknowledge that it's the Fed's job to control inflation, but also he does not want to criticize nor direct the Fed. And I believe he's doing this for two reasons. First, Joe Biden very much does not want to be Trump. In fact, I think he wakes up every day and he taps a sign that says, don't be like Trump today. And Trump yelled at the Fed when the stock market wasn't going in the right direction, let alone if inflation was getting out of control. Second, and on the other side, he does not want to be Carter. Jimmy Carter famously dealt with inflation in a very harsh manner. He appointed Paul Volcker to the Fed chairmanship, and Volcker dramatically raised interest rates, putting the economy already dealing with inflation in a vice, leading to unemployment and, historically, it's seen as the curse of Carter's presidency. So the plan is to let the Fed slowly raise interest rates in hope that this cools inflation as supply chains continue to get back online. Now, there's one more moment that I do believe was orchestrated, but was not directly Biden related that I think is smart. And it's this.
Big economic problem facing the United States right now. But it wasn't just the president who got it wrong a year or so ago. I want to play for you what you said about inflation last year. Listen to this.
Is there a risk of inflation? I think there's a small risk, and I think it's manageable. I don't anticipate that inflation is going to be a problem, but it is something that we're watching very carefully.
Was it a mistake, Madam Secretary, to downplay this inflation risk? Did that contribute to the problems we're all seeing right now?
Well, look, I think I was wrong then about the path that inflation would take.
That is Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen with an act of contrition. I was wrong. I, for one, applaud this. The Biden administration, and I think Democrats in general, have a nasty habit of trying to, quote unquote, expert themselves out of things. If you're wrong on something or public opinion is turning against you on something, just produce a list of 11 nonpartisan experts that say you're right. Oh, it's a magic cure-all. But at least this acknowledges what America sees plainly. You told me it was transitory. It wasn't transitory. It's here, and it's a problem. And as we all know, admitting you have a problem is the first step. Politics, politics, politics is brought to you by the folks who give us money. At TakePoliticsSeriously.com, that is our subscriber program, that is our Patreon, that is your portal to getting two bonus episodes each and every week. Two! You're doubling your output of PX3 content. Man, I can't thank you guys enough. Can't thank you guys enough for sticking with us through the big travel election season. We didn't have a gigantic increase. I think we actually wound up losing money because people were shifting their donations around, which is like, look, I understand. We may or may not be currently in a recession, so I'm not going to cry if people got to readjust their budgets a little bit. That being said, the fact that I make the money that I make, the fact that we continue to stay at the level that we stay at means the world to me because it allows me to go out and cover these races the way I know that you deserve to hear them covered. If you want to keep this going, if you want to double your PX3 output, you need to go to TakePoliticsSeriously.com. our guest today is somebody for whom shares a bewilderment. Indeed, why is somebody with the legislative prowess of Joe Biden so, well, impotent in his first 2 years? Well, according to a new book, it's because of some of the lessons that might have been learned the wrong way during the Biden administration. He has written about it. We will now talk about it. Ladies and gentlemen, from the Washington Monthly, Bill Scheer is back on the show. Welcome back, Bill.
Always good to talk to you.
What is going on with this Biden character, man? Like, I just, you know, we talked about it earlier on the show, on this episode, his new pivot to the economy that also has a lot of, hands off, Congress needs to do stuff, and also the Fed needs to do stuff, as if him being legislator in chief was not the greatest talent that he had going into this. Like, he was the Senate guy for Obama. He was literally the Senate for so many years before. And now there is a hands off. And you wrote a great piece in Washington Monthly about some of the legislative strategy that came out of the Obama administration and some of the people surrounding him that might explain why there has been so much futility.
Yeah, I'm definitely flummoxed by the way the Biden presidency has gone, because he ran on being the legislative maestro, and he served that function for Obama.
Yes.
And when people in the primary were dogging Obama because there's a critique that Obama bent over backwards too much for Republicans. He let the legislation get watered down.
Pre-negotiated. Is that the slur for which progressives will spit on the ground when it is mentioned.
And he wasted time. He wasted time in the Obamacare process, chasing Chuck Grassley and other moderate Republicans, and couldn't get any of them and still compromised anyway. And Biden was the guy in the primary saying, hey, stop busting Obama's chops.
Yeah,
we did great things. So it's weird that and some of this information comes from the new book, This Will Not Pass, by the New York Times reporters Jonathan Marr and Alex Burns, that a lot of the people on Biden's team internalized the critique of Obama.
Yeah.
And vowed not to repeat those mistakes, quote unquote. And Biden, the book, seems a little more conflicted about it. You know, there's actually a scene in the book early on where he's talking to Chris Dodd, the former senator, yeah, who was also in Biden's inner circle. And Biden saying, Dodd, you know, I want to get in there. I want, let's make some magic happen. I'm not quoting here.
Yeah, paraphrasing.
Dodd's like, I know, Joe, you're great at this stuff, but you're president now. You can't walk into a room without knowing what the outcome is going to be when you're president. So he was getting advice to back off. And I understand what Dodd's saying there, but nevertheless, you could conclude, you know, it's not Joe's job to literally do the horse trading without embracing the critique that Obama tried too hard. And so what happened was, instead of Democrats, this is what sort of, you know, drove my interest in exploring this. The narrative that came in many respects from the outside of the White House, the narratives that we weave on the internets and in newspaper columns, you know, a lot of it was driven by Paul Krugman at the Times, who was complaining about Obama's strategy in real time in 2009. You know, he pushed the wasting time argument and the stimulus is too small argument in real time. That mattered.
Yeah.
It wasn't just idle chatter. It actually affected the way Democrats see themselves and influenced a president's strategy. So Obama, at the end of the day, certainly in those first 2 years, said, what can get me to 60? What do I need to accommodate the determining vote?
Yes.
And that's going to determine my agenda. And so some people were complaining, well, Obama had 60, Biden only had 50. Well, Obama wasn't doing reconciliation.
Yes.
So he was still playing for what does the determining vote need to get for me to get?
Yes.
Stimulus, for me to get Obamacare, for me to get Dodd-Frank. And for Biden to say, you know what, screw 60, I'm going to get 50. Hey, fine. I get the argument that 10 Republicans was a hard reach in a lot of respects. But if that's going to be your path, you still need to accommodate your 50th vote, your yes. determining vote.
You need that.
And I started thinking, in retrospect, it's not that Obama didn't push at all. He wasn't completely submissive.
No,
he was still in the, but he's still at the end of the day listening hard. What does Susan Collins, Olympia Snow, and Arlen Specter need for stimulus? There was a brief moment when there were literally 60 Democrats because Specter switched,
yep.
and Al Franken got sworn in,
yep.
and Ted Kennedy hadn't died yet.
Yep.
But who was 60 in this? Then 60 is Joe Lieberman,
yes,
or Ben Nelson, and they were like, we don't want public option, we don't want Medicare buy-in for 55 and older. And so Obama had to say, you know what, that's where 60 is right now.
So let's go back and circle in on Obamacare, because that to me is the moment for which progressives become an animating force of, okay, we've lost faith in Obama, that Obama mm-hmm. is hope and change, but not the hope and change we wanted. And I do think that that has ramifications going into 2016. But if we're to zero mm-hmm. in on that Obamacare negotiation, where mm-hmm. I think the Titanic splits after hitting the iceberg ideologically on the left, it is the public option debate. And it's the public mm-hmm. option debate that is there to accommodate Nelson and Lieberman. And what's fascinating about that from the very beginning is that initially Obamacare didn't have a public option. It was only when it looked like it was definitely going, that it had a chance for success, that the progressive argument became, well, here we are at the gates, we got to go for everything, without understanding that, boy, this is on a real thin line. And you can call Joe Lieberman's bluff, you can call Nelson's bluff, and you can say, hey, we're going to put it on the floor, vote for it or don't. And I feel like that's the strategy that we got this time. And guess what? The answer was don't. The answer was no. It was no for two people. And that is, to me, it's such a logical leap to say, well, people will bow under public pressure if we just put it there. And it is an ignorance of how these kind of big time negotiations have gotten done throughout history, where it's like, yeah, it might look like somebody caved at the very end, but when you read the history books and you read how the machinations normally went, it's rarely because they felt bullied or they felt, you know, cowed by public pressure. It's because somebody gave somebody something, or there was some kind of horse trading at the very end.
You know, I can speak on the public option history for a long time and go really deep in the weeds with you on it.
Yeah.
And I'm happy to do it. So I just want to warn you.
Let's get in our time machine. Let's go back to 09.
So I wasn't like literally in the room or anything. I'm not like a player here, but the group that I worked for at the time was really big in the public option push.
Gotcha.
Was part of the group that helped put together the public option coalition, then being Healthcare for America Now. I mean, I didn't work for Healthcare America Now, I worked for a different group. We were the people that actually took the idea of public option to the presidential candidates.
Yeah.
In 2007.
Yeah.
And sold it on John Edwards first.
Yeah.
And then Hillary and Obama come along. And I was actually, for some inexplicable reason, like on the phone in the conference call where the Obama people tell us Obama is going to be for it.
Gotcha.
And in that discussion, because it wasn't like a big headline when Obama put out his plan. This is in 2007.
Yeah.
It wasn't like Obama for a public option. It was them on the phone saying, you see that footnote on page 10?
Yeah.
That's where the public. We're like,
you
really,
did it. Really, you there? Did it, guys. And you have your jeweler's loop is in right. in your eye as right. you're trying to see it.
So it wasn't a point of division. In the primary,
no,
because all of the main candidates got on board for it. And then it being the bigger point of tension was between Hillary and Barack over individual mandate.
Yeah.
And there was a point there where it became like the progressive thing to be for individual mandate. Hillary was better than Obama because Obama wasn't for individual mandate.
Yeah.
And that's logically a Krugman driven argument. Then when Obama, so public option is not an issue in the general election. It wasn't the thing that McCain and Obama were debating over. Yeah. And when Obama makes his first statement on healthcare as president in 2009, he lays out his list of principles. Public option is not there.
Not on it.
It's only, and at this point, it isn't even like that big a thing in progressive circles, despite my group's best efforts. A little bit after that point, Howard Dean comes out and says,
and he is DNC chair at that time, right?
I think he is not DNC chair.
It's pre-DNC Dean.
No, it's post. It's post.
Post-DNC Dean. Oh, okay.
If I remember correct, because he was okay. DNC chair in 2000, in 2006 cycle.
Okay. All right. We're getting more in the weeds here. Go ahead.
Because Obama tapped W. Wasserman Schultz, who everyone loved as DNC chair.
Oh, of course. Yeah. Universally popular. My congressman or congresswoman growing up, by the way.
So when Dean comes out for public option, I believe that was February, if I remember correctly, then it becomes like the thing. And of course, this is also in conjunction with the group coalition my group helped put together, Healthcare for America Now, making it a thing.
Yeah.
And this got kind of retconned during this process where a lot of progressives said, Obama promised us. He promised us public option. And I was like, yeah, I mean, he said he was for it.
Yeah.
He didn't like set a blood oath that was going to be there.
It was a campaign statement, not necessarily a promise. That did not quite elevate to promise.
And because I was paying attention so early in the process,
yes,
and I saw the initial statement of principles as president, I was always like, this is not his red line.
Yeah.
And that's why I was really disoriented. This always progressives tried to argue with a lot of cherry picked quotes, make it seem like it was his red line.
So where does that come from your perspective, especially being amongst the advocacy side, like how does it become something where it's like, well, you promised and now I'll be upset if it doesn't happen? Because my view from the outside is that as soon as the possibility of success exists, then all of a sudden everybody wants to add their thing to the tab.
I mean, I'm speaking from memory here, so excuse me if I'm slandering inadvertently. I don't want to put it all on this one person. I recall David Sirota, for example, making a big, big deal that Obama promised us this.
Gotcha.
And driving that argument. I'm sure others did too. But it definitely was in the mix that this was becoming an expected thing for Obama to fight for.
Yeah.
And then here he is for months and months and months trying to beg for Chuck Grassley to come over and for Olympia Snow to come over. And so this is driving progressives insane that this is not happening. And so at the end of the day, he gets something passed. It doesn't have public option in it. It has individual mandate all of a sudden, which had been the progressive thing, but now progressives don't care about that.
Nobody cares about individual mandate, which was always going to be a more, you know, a very politically fraught situation, as we've seen in the interview.
And the reason why that got in there is because the insurance lobby was like, we're cool with that. We're cool with people being legally obligated to buy our product.
Yeah, no, I'm sure.
That doesn't make us upset.
No.
But if you're going to create a government plan to compete with us, undercut us, then we're going to go scorched earth on you.
Yeah.
Now, again, the insurance lobby didn't, you know, shower roses over the proposal, but I don't think they fought as hard as they fought Hillary care in the 90s.
Yeah, because it created an oligopoly of protected, now legally required insurance.
And the insurance lobby then helped save Obamacare in 2017 by attacking Ted Cruz's repeal proposal. And if you go back to the Clinton care thing, this is something else I think is Hillary and Bill were the Bernie Sanders. They were fighting the insurance lobby.
Yeah.
I don't know if you remember the Harry and Louise ads. We talked about this in the Better Pass show.
No. Here we go. Go ahead. Because this is something that I have the very beginning of my political awareness.
How old are you? Can I ask how old you are?
I am 39 years old. So
okay, so we are about 10 years difference.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So you were probably not really paying attention in 1993 and 4 during all this.
The very beginning of me being aware of politics.
I mean, there was this ad campaign run by the insurance lobby. It was the Harry and Louise ads. If you look at it now, you look at me like, this was a devastating ad.
Yeah.
This seems like so quaint, but it was literally like a husband and wife around a kitchen table piled up with bills, tearing their hair out at how expensive healthcare has become because of the Bill Clinton's awful bill. And when those ads ran, the bill had not been written yet.
Yeah.
There was a preemptive strike on the bill by the insurance lobby because Hillary was going around the country lacerating insurance companies.
Yeah.
So they had every reason to believe they're going to get hammered in this process. And so they were striking back, and they told the White House, hey, you get Hillary to stop haranguing us and we'll pull the ads.
Yeah.
But the Clinton said, no deal. This from their perspective, the whole point was to
stick it to the insurance companies. Yeah. To try to rally public support against insurance companies.
So it was a completely Bernie style.
Yes.
War against a corporate interest. And what happened was the insurance lobby quintupled their fundraising through the battle and ran more ads.
Yeah.
And so the whole thing was become controversial before it even got drafted.
Yeah.
So the Obama team, Rahm Emanuel, who was in the Congress at the time, he was aware of that history. He was breaking bread with these corporate lobbies, and more so with the drug lobby than the insurance lobby. The drug lobby literally created its own ad campaign with the Harry and Louise actors.
Jesus.
to do Harry and Louise ads in favor of Obamacare.
Yeah.
Because Obama was going to give them a sweetheart deal.
Yes. Now,
and you tell this history, progressives say, this is why we hate everything. This is why we don't get nice things.
Yeah.
And so I understand that critique. But at the end of the day, Obamacare passed. More people got health insurance. It didn't go as far as universal care. It didn't go as far as Obama intended because the Supreme Court, cut a leg off of the whole plan.
Yeah.
And then the Republicans tanked it. I mean, and I think this also goes on Obama's shoulders. The individual mandate was not a strong individual mandate. They were very nervous about having a stiff penalty with tough enforcement. So it never was fully implemented. And so when Republicans took away that pillar, you didn't even notice it because it was barely being implemented in the first place.
Yeah.
That's the long public option.
I'm going to make it even longer. One more. Go. I love it.
When the initial bill passed the Senate with 60 votes, it was because at this point, Obama's still kind of trying. Harry Reid's kind of trying. But Joe Lieberman says, nope, I was for public option before, and now I'm not.
Yeah.
He was for Medicare buying, which is kind of like a smaller version of public option. He said, no, I'm not. You can't have it. You were mean to me in the election in 2006, and now you can't have it.
Yeah.
And a couple other Democrats apparently were sort of like cheering Lieberman on there. And so Obama and Reid say, okay, well, this is what we can get for 60. No public option. Hey, Nancy Pelosi, you're going to have to shove this down the House's throat, even though you passed the public option version. And Pelosi, being a realist, said, that's what we're going to do. Now, after the Senate passes the bill with 60, and it goes back to the House, makes some other changes
Yeah.
And during this time, Ted Kennedy dies.
Yes.
Is replaced by Republican Scott Brown, and Democrats don't have 60 votes anymore.
So, and if I remember correctly, part of it to get it back to the House were concessions to Nelson that then got stripped out in the House that then was part of this process as well, right?
I forget exactly what the changes were.
Yeah.
But the point being, because the House made changes, it had to go back to the Senate, where they no longer had 60.
Yeah.
And so the follow-up bill became a reconciliation bill.
Yes.
And because can't be filibustered. And then the public option would say, hey, you don't need 60 anymore. Jam public option through. And that's where Democrats said, we don't have 50
on public option
through reconciliation, which probably wouldn't even qualify for reconciliation, unless you did it through, you could expand Medicare, I think, the reconciliation, but you couldn't create a whole new government program through it. So there was an extra frustration that Democrats didn't get creative and push public option through that way. But it all comes down to, what can you get with your 50th vote? You know, progressives were saying, we did a whip count and we have more than 50 for this, but it didn't say exactly what version of it that you could do with the reconciliation. And so, this is how the narratives begin, because people spin.
Let me see if, you know, we can get kind of a drill down on this one idea. For progressives, was the capitulation to Lieberman and then the reconciliation without the public option when you might have the final hammer there, is that worse than getting something, the absence of getting everything being worse than getting something?
Well, I mean, certainly my argument is Obama got something. More people have health insurance today than before.
And this is what got codified. And I think this is also one of those things where when you look at Obama's approval rating, you know, even through his reelection against Romney, and then certainly leading into 2016, the progressive argument that I have heard is, yeah, of course we lost in 2016. Obama betrayed the left. He betrayed progressives by not going far enough when he had the hammer.
Well, I think that critique was even farther, that Obama's policies weren't robust enough. They didn't help people immediately enough. They didn't affect their day-to-day lives and make them more financially secure enough. And therefore, you couldn't run on a strong record. And look, a lot of times policymaking does not lead to astounding immediate outcomes. A lot of times it's by hook and by crook, and things are imperfect, and you do a little bit better over here, but a little worse over there. And you got to keep fine tuning and adding, you know, governing is messy. But because there was this negative critique on the whole record, again, also combined with that Obamacare took so long and wasted time and tried to get votes that he couldn't get. And what was the point of all that? Let's do it a different way this time. Screw the Republicans.
Yes.
Use reconciliation to the max. Go big in what you're proposing. Since you're not going for, you're not straining for 60, you can go bigger with 50. This is why I feel like people complain to me, well, Obama had 60. Your argument is that you could do more with 50. So don't tell me that the 60 thing means Obama magically gets bigger bills. The point is, you have to go as far as the determining vote lets you go. So if you're going to go with 50, hey, have at it. But figure out what that 50th vote needs.
Understand that Manchin and Sinema are going to do the final draft on your bill because they're the ones.
And when they were tapping the brakes, people were saying, how dare Manchin and Sinema get in the way? There's 48 of us and only two of them. Don't they know math? Don't they know that they're standing in the way of the majority? No, they make the majority. They give you the majority. This is basic political science, basic legislative competence. You can only go as far as the determining vote lets you go. And so for Biden, this is where the biggest as of malpractice in my mind. I don't want to be, I don't hate Joe Biden. You know, I'm not saying Joe Biden's a bad president and he shouldn't be reelected if he runs again and you should vote Republican in the midterm. I'm not saying any of that. There's still good that's happened in the past 18 months, in my opinion, but we should be honest about where the mistakes were. You go reconciliation for the American Rescue Plan. You slide in an expanded child tax credit without much debate. You do it for 1 year on the presumption if you go big and there's an immediate benefit in people's pockets, they're going to love it. Yep. And politicians will be terrified to get rid of it. And it'll be really easy to extend it indefinitely after that 1 year point.
Yeah.
And a lot of it worked as intended. People did get their money. It did cut child poverty by nearly half. However, there were Democrats almost immediately afterwards saying, I don't know about extending it. It's really expensive. If we're going to do it, we're going to have to pay for it. And that didn't like strike fear in the heart of the Biden White House. I mean, the fact that I got in there in the first place without knowing they would have 50 to extend it, boggles my mind. I mean, Biden has been around long enough to know that you can't count your chickens before they hatch. So to slip it in there, not knowing you have 50 for an extension, and then tout it as like your biggest history-making legacy achievement, only to see Joe Manchin say, sorry, guy, I'm not with you. I mean, that's just malpractice.
But I think, all right, so there are two things and one thing that came out of that you've mentioned a few times, but I do want to highlight that came out of the Obama era is the idea of never trust a Republican. The Republicans are not here for you. They are not your friends. They will not. A bipartisan gesture is a wasted effort. It is wasted energy. Mitch McConnell is the guy who pulls the football away from Charlie Brown. Like that's where all that. Gets in our modern era very much gets crystallized. That being said, so we have that and everything else we've talked about in terms of the go big or go home. There's no need to pre-negotiate. Let's if we have 50, then we are going to jam everything that we need through their maximum pressure. The problem with Lieberman was that he didn't feel enough heat and he didn't have to have his career flash before his eyes when he decided to vote yes or no on the Senate bill that we want, no matter whatever he wants. Like he's going to eventually melt in the face of this pressure. So those are the lessons that all kind of come together. The unfortunate thing for Joe Biden, and this is something that I'm sure you watched, you know, firsthand, especially through Obama, is that he's kind of the bipartisan guy. He's the guy who, you know, made the connection between Obama and John Boehner because they both smoked cigarettes either secretly or not. Right. Like that's the kind of old Senate thing that he is, you know, supposed to be, at least in everything that I've read, a very, very good at. And it's building the coalitions that are his thing. Whereas it seems like everybody around him and that ultimately had the loudest voices in the final decisions on how they went about things were no, coalitions are useless. And in fact, we are not building a coalition. We are calling our banners. It is loyalty to Democrat overall. And if you don't vote for it, then you are going to be a traitor to our party. And we are going to openly talk about primarying you, at least in the case of Kyrsten Sinema.
There's a few things I want to say about that. I mean, one is if you read the book, This Will Not Pass. The takeaway I got from her was that Biden was genuinely conflicted about these two things. That there's there's the longstanding bipartisan aspect to him wanting to bring the country together, show that Washington can work and the Senate can work, and he's good at this stuff. That was still in him, but he was also tantalized by the idea he was going to be more transformational than Barack Obama, who's going to be the next FDR. Yeah. This 1.9 trillion American Rescue Plan is just sitting there waiting to be picked off the tree, and we just build on that from there. And clearly, as the evidence shows, he leaned that way more. Now, he did do infrastructure. He did have a process where he let Manchin take the lead and craft the bill to his liking. And even after the whole song and dance with Build Back Better and the linkage and all that stuff, they eventually break the linkage in November and pass the infrastructure by itself. So on some level, you know, Biden knows that the center outweigh can work. And he knows Mitch McConnell well enough to know that there are things that McConnell will be cooperative on, but just you have to deal with them, you know, in a steely, cold, cold way.
I think you've said it before, and I totally agree. Mitch McConnell stabs you in the front.
Right.
He's not, I don't, this idea that he is a Machiavellian in promising something and then taking it away, I have not personally seen. He is somebody that goes on television, you know, if you asked him right now in front of a microphone, if we get the Senate and another Supreme Court justice dies, will you hold it until the election? He'll say yes. He'll say, like, he's not going to be like, oh,
he might throw me a little bit of a wink and a nod there, but basically, yes.
Yes, but yeah, he's not coy about this stuff.
And look, I mean, the irony of the past year is that I think McConnell has been nicer to Biden than Obama. I mean, they did it. He did infrastructure. He did debt limit. He did the China competitiveness bill. He did the anti-Asian hate crimes bill.
He's letting Cornyn talk about guns right now.
Right. I mean, look, Manchin's not going to give you the whole agenda. You know, he's not going to give you the whole progressive wish list. And so if you don't want to be limited by McConnell's stinginess, you're going to say, screw him, do a reconciliation. And again, I'm like, fine if you have 50 votes. And so you talk about wasting time.
Yeah.
Biden wasted months and months of time trying to get Manchin on Build Back Better and literally got nothing out of it. So I don't see Obama wasting time on Obamacare. He got Obamacare. He got something there. He did what he had to do to get to number 60. It may be that Manchin's, the one critique is, well, Manchin's was not bargaining good faith. Manchin was moving the goalposts. And it's hard to totally adjudicate that from the outside because you know exactly what he was being said.
What he's saying internally, yeah.
Right. But we do know that Manchin gave an offer to Chuck Schumer in July of 2021 for $1.5 trillion. And for some inexplicable reason, Schumer did not share that with Biden and Pelosi right away. But we also admit that Manchin had this offer in December. That was around $1.8 trillion, but it put the kibosh on the child tax credit. And Biden was like, I don't know about that. And in that hesitation period, Manchin put a stake to the whole thing. And all of this says to me that if you had the heart-to-heart with Manchin in January 2021.
Yeah.
How far can we go here? You lead the process. I know you're 50, as opposed to, I'm going to put together this giant proposal the way I like it and try to foist it on you. That latter strategy was the time-wasting strategy.
Yes.
Infrastructure, where Manchin led it, happened relatively quickly. Yeah.
The only thing that really stopped it was the fight with the House.
So people convince themselves, going back to McConnell, that McConnell's game was maximum dysfunction. Don't waste your time letting him twist your wrist around his finger, because what he wants is to give you absolutely nothing.
Yeah.
So everything is terrible and you get blamed. That wasn't wholly made out of whole cloth.
No.
So I can pick things that McConnell has said to suggest that was his game. But you test the proposition. What I would have done is go for 60 on the American Rescue Plan. Go for 60.
Yes.
Would have been smaller.
Got it before twice. Right.
Right. And I would have tried a lot harder there. You could have taken the Collins offer off the top. It would have been a third of the size of the American Rescue Plan. But would it have destroyed America? I don't think so. And you probably could have moved them up. You probably could have gotten to around a trillion, I think. Do that. Do infrastructure. See what you do next. Go as far as you can with 60.
Yes.
And then say, okay, the well is dry here. Hey, Manchin, we really gave 60 a good shot. What can I do with you with 50? I so agree with you.
And if you look at Biden's tone now, I mean, I'll tell you what, man, go and if you want to, you know, have this level of political nerdery, but like, go watch his joint speech to Congress, his first, State of the Union-esque speech. and then watch the State of the Union that happened roughly a year afterward. And boy, is the tone and tenor of the big progressive hammer Biden that exists in the first one. And then it's fund the police. We need to reach across the aisle Biden 1 year later. And I think that that is the dichotomy.
And I haven't gone back and looked, but I'm sure it's the same with, you know, Obama's first ones and his latter ones and Bill Clinton's first ones. And then you have Arab big government is over.
Yeah.
You know, you should try as hard as you can to go big in your first year when you got your honeymoon period.
What we're saying, and I think we're agreeing, is that for Biden, especially coming out of the Trump White House, especially like in a world where people had a lot of chaos and we literally just saw people storming the Capitol, the idea of let's bang out whatever bipartisan stuff that we can was, I think, a political opportunity left on the table for him that when you talk about wasted time. Boy, that entire Build Back Better. I mean, I regret just having to cover it for 6 months.
I mean, one other point, though, because I also think this comes to the misguided narratives coming out of Obama. Obamacare is literally the only bill that Obama signed into law with no Republican votes. He needed Republican votes and everything else. Now, maybe it was, just a couple.
Yeah.
But again, he did what he had to do to get to 60. And this accounts for stimulus. This counts for Dodd-Frank. This counts for a don't ask, don't tell repeal. This counts for food safety regulations. This counts for unemployment insurance extensions. This counts for the tax reforms that got passed. Everything he did needed some Republican vote. With Dodd-Frank, he lost Russ Feingold.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't progressive enough. And so getting, at this point, our inspector already switched parties.
Yeah.
And you had to get Snow and Collins, the two moderates out of Maine. But without Feingold, he had to go to Scott Brown. And Scott Brown said, well, you got to get rid of this bank tax.
Yeah.
And Obama said, oh, I'll get rid of this bank tax because that's what's going to get me to 60. Because I think Feingold, if I remember correctly, wanted to do the break up the banks proposal.
Yeah.
And that was a bridge too far for Obama. And there's an argument whether that was because Obama didn't like it on the policy grounds or whether he thought it couldn't pass, be it as it may, whatever it is, he wasn't going to do it. And so he said to get the 60, he needed to accommodate Scott Brown's provincial interest. So it wasn't like 20 Republicans on most things, but you do what you have to do to get the 60. And if it's going to be 50, you do what you do to get to 50. Biden wasn't doing that. When he crafted Build Back Better,
it was pressure and loyalty. That was the strategy.
People assumed, and I understand, again, it's not completely fantastical. Manchin did vote for the American Rescue Plan. He was complaining about partisanship, then still voted for it. And so people assume, Manchin does the song and dance, but he's with you at the end of the day because he's a Democrat. I mean, I get the thinking, but clearly in retrospect, too simplistic of thinking. He was complaining about partisanship early and it indicated that he was doing this reluctantly and did not want to continue doing things that way. And this is why you don't base your legislative strategy on a few cherry pick comments. You get in a room and talk to them privately and figure out what's really going on.
That is a thing that I feel like has increased the more that politics has become mainstream and people that normally, like me and you, we're old barnacled nerds about this. Like we would talk about this to the point where we would bore a dinner party 10 years ago, right? But now it's a thing. People want to talk about it a lot. What winds up becoming more in the mainstream are those cherry picked quotes, are those cherry picked arguments, are those very politically shaved realities. Whereas look, when you're running for office, when you're trying to shape public opinion, I get that these things are out there. the reality is a lot more complicated. And the reality are in these books about, you know, the little chapters of history and how the nitty gritty negotiations have gone. And if you only believe the frosting, if you only believe the narrative, then it's very easy to put yourself in this fantasy world where all it takes is just, you know, that one big fight and that one finger in the face of the senator to say, you better get on board, mister. But that's not how it works. It's never how it's worked. Like you said, you get to the number that you need, and that's it. And then once you pass it, then you highlight all the great things about the bill. You downplay all the negative things about the bill that you had to do to make it cross the finish line.
One thing that also drives me a little batty is that Democrats have told themselves that Republicans do what they want all the time. Republicans blow through every norm possible.
Yeah.
And so why do we have to be the goody two shoes? And I have to remind them, you know what? George W. Bush ran through those tax cuts real early through reconciliation, but he had to get Democratic votes for it, which he got. And those moderates would not let him make those tax cuts permanent. In fact, and Bush was shaking his fist all through his second term, make my tax cuts permanent, and they wouldn't do it. And because they didn't do it, Obama was able to undo the lion's share of them in regards to the upper income brackets on the wealthy, which is what Bush really cared about the most. Some people say, well, they kept most of them. They kept most of them for the middle class. What Bush wanted was to cut top rates for the wealthy. That's what he didn't get to keep. And then Donald Trump, Obamacare repeal. They tried to ram through with 50 votes, and you know, Collins and Murkowski and McCain, you know, wouldn't let them. You know, they have had the same problems too, trying to do too much with the limited majorities that they had, not listening to where the determining vote is. They are just as bound by political math as Democrats are. You got to read the room if you're going to actually get stuff passed.
I'll tell you what, that's the best way that we can go out on this particular conversation. Bill, what do you have coming up?
You know, I'm actually working on a piece right now about, you know, Biden and guns in the economy. You alluded to this right at the very top, that Biden's all of a sudden talking about the economy.
Yeah.
And, you know, to my mind, that's a signal that he knows inflation's going to determine November, not guns. He's not single-minded focused on guns, and Democrats have almost never been single-minded focused on guns, and the public is never single-minded focused on guns. Our attention always wanes after a couple weeks after a horrible mass shooting. But having said that, I don't think that necessarily means that we can't pass something, and this may be a case where Biden's going to do better than Obama, because in the Obama case, he actually, I might have said this on a past show, he was going to push immigration reform first in the second term. And the ducks were kind of lined up for it. Then Sandy Hook happens, and he feels morally obligated to try to do gun control, which he didn't really run on in either election. He was very low key on guns, arguably helping him win in a lot of, you know, reddish places. But they feel that they have to. And Obama comes out in January, a month after Sandy, with this giant gun control plan, which has no shot of getting passed. Yeah. And here's where I think wasting time does matter, because people's attentions do fade quickly on gun control. You got to really act quickly to get something passed there. They lose that momentum. He has to settle for the Manchin Toomey narrow background check bill. And at that point, the momentum's gone. They can't get the 60 on it. Biden maybe playing a lower key role here, letting Chris Murphy talk to Republicans saying, hey, what can we get 64? It's probably, if it's going to be something, it's probably going to be small, probably going to be red help for states with their red flag programs. I think
that's the most likely in my opinion is that it'll be money for states to run red flag laws. And, you know, you will know that it has got momentum if two things happen. Number one, I agree. You start to hear little background things of like, well, you know, Joe Biden has been, you know, helping out with X, Y, or Z, because that's always a sign that it might be closer to the finish line. And B, if people start talking more about successes of it in Florida, because that will moderate it in a way. It's like, well, if Florida's doing it.
What Chris Murphy said the other day is he's trying to tell Republicans, you can do this and be politically successful. I mean, Biden saying, hey, Mitch McConnell, he's rational. John Cornyn, he's rational. Chris Murray's like, hey, yeah, this is not to beat you up upside the head in November. This is going to be good for you. This is going to expand your support. They're trying to strike those bipartisan tones. They're learning the mistakes, I think, from the past year. And in doing so, might do better than Obama on this score.
I would tend to agree. I think that Biden, you know, it's like the old parable of the frog and the scorpion. At the end of the day, you cannot outrun your nature. And Biden's nature is the bipartisan guy. The fact that he masqueraded for 2 years as something other, I think, will ultimately be a mistake. What's not a mistake is our lovely conversations with Bill Scherer of The Washington Monthly and many, many more outlets. Please go find his writing there and everywhere. Thank you very much, Bill.
Thank you.
Politics, Politics, Politics is written and hosted by me, Justin Robert Young, for Dog and Pony Show Audio in Austin, Texas. Our show is edited by Brett Stewart. PX3Guest.com is where you need to go to tell Bill Scherer he did a great job. You guys know how much that matters, so please head on over there right now. You can always email me, theyoungamerican@gmail.com, and our Twitter is PX3Tweets. When I'm live on the internet, I'm at PX3Live.com, and you can share this podcast with your friends, family, and clergy at PX3Podcast.com. You can get your merch, politicsmerch.com. You can support this program, paypal.me/payjury. Venmo is Justin-Young-20, and our Cash App is at PX3Cash. You can send anything that you would like to me in the mail, P.O. Box 153184, Austin, Texas, 78715. Again, P.O. Box 153184, Austin, Texas, 78715. Of course, you can always get our bonus content at TakePoliticsSeriously.com. $3 tier gets you 2 bonus podcasts per week covering all the news that we miss on our free podcast schedule. And the $10 tier gets your name read at the end of the podcast, like these fine folks in the Titanic. $10 tier. V-Guard, Alexis, Neil of Neils, MC Dradio, Unsafe DB Levels, Katie, Double K Ranch, Amanda, Ye Ol' Pinball Shop, John, DP4 Bongo, Niemeister, Nick's Horseless Diner, Catherine, Persons Familiar with the Matter, and Vote Gloria Young for King of the New World Order. 100 Mile Runner, Edison, Up, Up, Down, Down, Left, Right, B.A. Start, Dr. G, Headphones, Neil, Charles, Darren, Idris Arslandian, Blue Front, and the Lenina, D.L., Steven, Chad, Nomadic Terran, Diana Shrill Shrieks, Miranda Janelle, Chief Andy, Robert Casey, Paul is awesome, Brad, Richard, D. Laser, Just Another Pilot, Middle Age Mike, Utah Jimmy Montana, The Gen, Adam L., D. Really, Chopper, J. Pink, Andrew, and Joshua. If you'd like to hear your name read, well, you can head on over there, TakePoliticsSeriously.com. Another hot weekend, baby. Get on out there. Drink some Topos, some White Claw. Just hydrate. Also, just hydrate. A lot of water. A lot of water. Be a hydro homie this weekend. We'll be back next weekend. We got some fun stuff for you. Till next time, this is your old pal Justin Robert Young saying, some shows talk about politics, others talk about politics, and still more discuss politics, but this is the only show that dares discuss all three.
Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.
Dog and Pony Show Audio.